And leave your Bibles open there to Luke chapter 16, and we're going to be doing just a textual study of Luke chapter 16 at the beginning of the chapter in what is called the parable of the unjust steward. Now, usually when we preach sermons from Luke 16, you know what we're preaching about. And our children would tell you that for the purposes of kids sing, their overall theme of Luke 16 is the rich man and Lazarus. But I want to bring this sermon from the first part of the chapter, which is a very interesting parable. Aren't there occasions when you would really like to hear the tone of voice with which Jesus said something? Sometimes you'll be reading a book, maybe it's not even the Bible, but a book of history or a book of literature, and you try to imagine, with what tone of voice did he say that? And I think sometimes that's why we enjoy movies being made about a literary work or about a historical event, because then we get to maybe visualize, how was that said? Or with what look was in his eye when he said that? Or with what tone of voice did he say that? I think about that when I read John chapter 2, for example, when Jesus performed the miracle of turning the water into grape juice. And I say grape juice because that's really the most honest way to say it. It's the word oinos, that's a generic word that could mean either intoxicating beverages or non-intoxicating beverages. So you have to let the context decide. And in that context, it's a non-intoxicating beverage. So Jesus turned the water into grape juice. And in that case, you remember Mary, the mother of Jesus, came to him and she said, "They have no more wine." And what was Jesus' response? He said, "Woman, what do I have to do with this? My hour is not yet come." And you know what she did? Jesus seems to say no. If you read Jesus' words literally, what he's saying is, I don't have anything to do with this. But that's not how she took it. Her response was to say to the servants, whatever he says, do it. In other words, he said no, literally, but she took it as a yes. Why did she take it as a yes? Because he had a twinkle in his eye or something like that? Because he maybe winked when he said it? Or maybe because he smiled to his mother and said, "Woman, what have I got to do with you? Now, what do I have to do with this situation? Mine hour is not yet come." I suppose they had had conversations about when his hour would come. When is the hour going to come when he's going to make public his ability, his power? And so he says in a loving way to his mother, no, literally. But she takes it as a yes, because they had a way of communicating such that the literal words that Jesus said were not what he meant to convey. But he conveyed his meaning very effectively, didn't he? I believe that's what's happening in Luke chapter 16. Because what we're going to see in this parable is that Jesus says some things that, to use my Alabama lingo, just they don't make no sense. When if you read them literally, if you take the words literally, they contradict other things that Jesus teaches in other places. So what is he doing? I submit to you that in this parable, Jesus is using some kind of irony or some kind of sarcasm whereby he says something that is opposite of the point he's trying to make. But we do that from time to time, don't we? I think, for example, here's a man where he looks out his front door and it's come a blizzard. And he looks out the front door and he says to his wife, "Fine day for a picnic." What does he really mean? We should go out there and have a picnic in the blizzard? No, he doesn't mean that at all. He's saying the opposite. What he's saying is, you could never have a picnic on a day like this. But what he literally says is, fine day for a picnic. Or what about somebody who's standing up in Congress? A congressman is arguing that we should not add any more taxes, for example. What if he gets up and says, "Go ahead and add some more taxes to the businessmen of America. Go ahead and burden them with more taxes. And then they'll be able to grow their businesses. And that everything will work out fine if you add more taxes." Well, he means the opposite of that. But what's he doing? He's using some sarcasm or he's using some irony in order to get his point across. And sometimes, if you've been saying your literal message over and over again and people don't seem to get it, then maybe the most effective way of communicating is to start using some kind of alternate way of communicating, such as irony or such as sarcasm or something like this. And in this passage, especially given the context, which we're going to examine in just a minute, Jesus is using some irony or some sarcasm, because he's been giving them a message about money that apparently they haven't completely gotten yet. He's been telling them repeatedly, as we will see, you got to watch out about your relationship to money. And then he tells a parable where somebody who's dishonest in order to get money is praised. and Jesus is going to drive his point home by using some irony. Okay, let's read the passage together. Luke 16, beginning in verse 1, and we'll go through verse 13. He said to the disciples, or also said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, or your translation may say steward, somebody who takes care of the possessions of another. And so this is traditionally called the parable of the unjust steward or manager. There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man, this steward, was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, "What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager." And the manager said to himself, "What shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me?" So I take it to mean he's sacked, to use the old English word for it. He is fired. He is not going to have a job now. And so now he's starting to think, where is my income going to come from? And he poses some possibilities to himself. He says, "I'm not strong enough to dig." He's a financial guy. He hasn't been doing much out in the field, I guess. He says, "I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. So I've decided what to do, so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their houses." What, he's got a plan whereby he can sort of retire and be supported by others. Now, you're probably thinking, maybe I could get in on some of that. Maybe I could figure out a deal where if I ever lose my job, I'll just work it so that people will take me into their homes and support me forever. Now, that doesn't work really very often, does it? But he's got him a plan. What do you think he's going to do? He says, I'll get a plan where they'll take me into their houses. So summoning his master's debtors one by one, I take it without the master knowing, he's going behind his master's back. He said to the first, "How much do you owe my master?" And he didn't tell this client that the master's firing him. He hasn't said that. He just says, "How much do you owe my master?" He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, "Take your bill and sit down and write 50. Then he said to another, "And how much do you owe?" He said, 100 measures of wheat. He said to him, "Take your bill and write 80. So I'm giving you a discount on this. Now, did he have any authority to give the... No, he's going behind his master's back. He's just making things up. He's just cutting. Wouldn't that be funny if you came to somebody who owed a credit card debt and you pretended that you were working for the credit card company? You said, "How much do you owe Chase?" I have a credit card from Chase that I use for gasoline, and it gives me some points. And so I get some benefits from that, and I just pay it off, you know, at the end of the month and so forth. What if somebody came and said, "I work for Chase, and how much do you owe?" "Well, I think I owe about $50. "Take it, just call it $25. You think Chase would be very happy with that? I don't think that would go over too well. Anyway, he says, "How much do you owe?" To this next one, 100 measures of wheat, he says, "Take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager. Wait a second. He commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. "For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth or ill-gotten gain." Your translation may say unrighteous mammon or the mammon of unrighteousness, unrighteous gain. "So that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. One who is faithful in a little is also faithful in much. And one who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. If you've not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you the true riches? And if you've not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." Now, the usual interpretation of this parable that I've heard over the years, and you may have heard as well, is that Jesus is trying to say that people out in the world are more shrewd in their business dealings than members of the church are in trying to accomplish spiritual goals. That if you take somebody, for example, who works out in the financial world, he may be very shrewd in making business deals. You know, sometimes political candidates, we've got one candidate I'm thinking of right now who is very often talking about the shrewdness of his business deals, and maybe all that's true, but Jesus very often is thought to be saying in this passage, you know, people out in the world are very shrewd in their business dealings, and then Christians sometimes don't know what they're doing. Sometimes Christians just are very ineffective in making plans and working things out for the benefit of the church. That's the usual interpretation. I want to question that today because I think Jesus is teaching a far more valuable lesson, but he's doing it by irony. So let's do this. Let's first ask some questions about this parable, and then we'll look at the larger context surrounding it, and then the lesson will be yours. It won't take very long. But here, let's first ask this question. Did this unjust steward really do the wise thing? You know, literally, Jesus says that he's doing the wise thing. You know, the children of this world are wiser than the children of light. And the master commends him in the parable. The master says, oh, this is wonderful. He appears to be commending him for doing something that's unrighteous. He appears to be saying, great job for cheating people. Now, is that consistent with what the New Testament says if we take it literally? No. All through the New Testament, we read about how important it is to be honest, how important it is to show things honest in the sight of all men, according to Romans chapter 12. And so repeatedly, we're told not to lie. But here we've got a man who goes around lying and cheating people, and then he comes back and his master says, great job. I think Jesus is using some kind of irony here. What about this question? Are the children of darkness or the children of this world really wiser than the children of light? That's what Jesus says, literally. But did Jesus really mean to say that in terms of literally, or was he trying to say something by means of irony? I think if we take him literally, he's contradicting what he said in Matthew chapter 7, verses 24 through 27. That's that what we just sang about with the children a moment ago. We sang from a story Jesus told about a wise man who built his house on the rock. And you know how Jesus introduced that story? He said, he that heareth these words of mine and doeth them, I will liken him unto a wise man. What does the wise man do? He obeys Jesus. He builds his house on the rock. But then here in Luke 16, Jesus says that the children of the world are the wise ones. Surely what Jesus is doing is saying the opposite of what he really means to make a point. And I trust that his point got across. Another question to ask about this is, do you think that somebody who cheats is going to just walk into somebody's house and be taken in to retire there? Is Jesus meaning to really say that that's how it works? I don't think so. Suppose there's a thief, and he's cheated some people for their benefit. You know, maybe he got them 50 measures of oil. That's about 800 or 900 gallons of oil. That's probably enough olive oil to last you. I suppose that's an awful lot of oil. So he did benefit them somewhat. But do you think that when they realize he cheated them in order to benefit them, that they're just going to take him right into their house and say, come and live with me. You're a thief and a cheat. Why don't you come and live in our guest room forever? I don't think that's what's going to happen. Jesus is saying he means something other than what he's literally saying. Well, let's ask this question. Does Jesus really mean to be teaching that we should make friends of unrighteous wealth? Jesus says, make friends by means of unrighteous wealth or ill-gotten gain. Is that consistent with what we read throughout the rest of the New Testament if we take it literally? No. What about James chapter 4 and verse 4, which says friendship with the world, if you're friends with this world with things like ill-gotten gain, if you're friends with the world, what are you? You're an enemy of God. Friendship with the world is enmity with God. But if we take Jesus literally, he's conflicting with what that says. So surely Jesus is saying the opposite of what he really means to say, what it really means. And then finally, let's ask ourselves this question. Do we think that unrighteous mammon or ill-gotten gain is going to get us an eternal habitations? Eternal habitation? Jesus says, make friends by the means of unrighteous wealth so that you can be received into eternal habitations. Have you ever heard a Christian preacher preach that message before? Literally? Listen, if you will cheat people, if you will place money above all else, if you will spend your life trying to even do what's wrong in order to get lots of money, then you'll be welcomed right into heaven. That's your ticket to heaven. Try to get into heaven by means of unrighteous wealth. Surely not. And so I think Jesus is making a big point about covetousness. At the end of this whole thing, he sums it up in verse 13 by saying, you cannot be friends with God and unrighteous mammon. You can't serve God and money. I think that was the point of the whole thing. It was the point that he's made other times about covetousness. Watch out about your relationship to money because you're liable to be covetous, which simply means that your love for money outruns your love for God. And he uses this illustration about an unjust steward who decided he would cheat people in order to get some money and in order to be received into their homes. And Jesus says, that's not going to work. He says, you try it. I think that was his tone. You try it. Go ahead and try to make friends of unrighteous mammon. Then you'll be received. Oh, you'll be received into eternal habitations if you make friends with unrighteous mammon. Of course, he's using irony. But let me set it up. Let me show you the context. And I think what we're going to see is that Luke chapter 12 through Luke chapter 16 is really the Bible's treatise on covetousness. If you start with Luke chapter 12 and you go all the way through Luke chapter 16, you read Jesus teaching about money. And this comes during that section. And it just happens over and over again. And this is just one small piece. The parable of the unjust steward is one small piece of Jesus' overall teaching about money that comes from the beginning of Luke chapter 12 through the end of Luke chapter 16. Okay, so turn back a couple of pages to Luke chapter 12 and let's notice this context together. In the first place, look at chapter 12 verses 13 to 15. Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." But he said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or arbitrator over you?" And he said to them, "Take care and be on your guard against all covetousness. For one's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." What's Jesus saying? Don't make for yourselves friends of unrighteous wealth. Don't make for your friends money. Don't anticipate getting to go to heaven based on unrighteous mammon. And then in the next few verses, Jesus tells a story that we call the story of the rich fool. And you know what the rich fool did. He had a farm that produced much. And his solution to his overabundance of farm produce was to tear down the barns he currently had because they couldn't hold all of his crops. And then he was going to build bigger barns, and that was going to solve the problem. That introduced a whole nother problem, didn't it? Because God came to him that very night and said, "You fool, this night your soul will be required of you." And it was because he had made friends of unrighteous mammon. Look at Luke 12, verse 21. At the end of the story of the rich fool, here's what Jesus said. "So is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." You see, we're seeing that Jesus is making a teaching about covetousness, and he's going to build up, and then eventually when you get to chapter 16, he's going to tell our story about this manager who's dishonest. And he's saying, don't make friends for yourselves, the mammon of unrighteousness. Okay, now, furthermore, and look down at chapter 12 and verse 28, when Jesus is teaching about not being anxious for the things of this world. He says, "But if God so clothes the grass, which is alive in the field today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? And do not seek what you are to eat and what you are to drink, nor be worried. For all the nations of the world seek after these things, and your Father knows that you need them. Instead, seek his kingdom, and these things will be added to you." And then, next passage, look at verse 33 of Luke 12. Jesus says, "Sell your possessions, give to the needy, provide yourselves with money bags that do not grow old, with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys." Is Jesus saying, if you make friends of yourself with unrighteous wealth, then you'll have eternal habitations? No, he's saying the opposite. See, Jesus is saying, watch out about your relationship with money. Don't get so desirous of the things of this world that you forget to lay up treasures in heaven. Now, let me pause there and ask this, especially to our parents and to our grandparents. Are we teaching our children that the most important thing to us is that we are laying up treasures in heaven? Or are we teaching them that there are some things that are much more important than laying up treasures in heaven, such as being excellent on the field of athletics, or such as attaining high marks in academic scholarship? As good as that is, as good as it is to be great on sports, and as good as it is to be great in academics, and I love school as much as the next person, but what about treasures in heaven? Are we teaching our children? What if a father taught his child a trade, and he taught him so wonderfully well? Maybe it's carpentry. Maybe it's how to manage money. Maybe it's how to help people plan their vacations. I don't know what it is. There are all kinds of trades. What if a father has a trade and he says, I'm going to really teach my son how to do this trade so that when he gets old, he'll know how to do something? The way my dad used to say it is, you want to have a marketable skill. You want to have something you can do for which people will support you so that you can do that job. And it's important for everybody who wants to earn a living to have some kind of job to do. But what if he teaches him how to do that trade, teaches him how to make money in this life, but doesn't teach him how to make any preparation for the next life? What if he teaches him all about how to be successful on earth, but he doesn't put any emphasis on the spiritual? You know, we talked about eternity this morning. Eternity is a lot longer than this life. I'm sure everybody is aware of that. But sometimes we may act as though we think this life is all there is. And we say, my son is so good at being a carpenter because I trained him that way. I taught him to do that. Or, my son is so good at preparing people's taxes. And you know where he learned it? He learned it from me. Or he learned it from his mother. And we really helped him learn how to manage things in this world. And then you say, very good. Well, where does he attend services? Where is he a member? Well, you know, we didn't train him so good in spiritual things. And we didn't put the proper emphasis on that. Well, wait a minute. Let's plan ahead, because eternity is a lot longer than that. And even after your children are retired, even after your grandchildren have quit their jobs and have gone on to die, eternity is still an issue. And we don't need to be making friends of unrighteous mammon, the mammon that we get by ill-gotten gain, or the mammon that we let take the place in our hearts where God ought to be. The motto of the university where I attended at Freed Hardeman was this: learning how to live and how to make a living. And both of those categories are very important. If you just train your children to learn how to make a living, well, that's fine. They need to know how to make a living, perhaps. But what about how to live? What about how to live so that they have eternal habitations? You see, Jesus' lesson in this parable of the unjust steward is, don't forget about those eternal habitations, because money won't get you there. You cannot buy your spot in heaven. You can't save enough money in your Edward Jones account, and I've got a tiny little Edward Jones account. You cannot take that Edward Jones account and pick your spot up in heaven. That won't do it. So don't make yourselves friends of this unrighteous mammon. Okay, but we're not done with this context. Look at Luke chapter 13 and notice verses 15 and 16. Now, let me tell you what happened right before this passage. Jesus cast a spirit out of a woman who had been afflicted in this unclean spirit for 18 years. And as Jim Herring has been teaching us in the Sunday morning Bible class, the Pharisees got real mad about that because they didn't think anybody ought to be doing anything at all, pretty much, on the Sabbath day. And so when Jesus healed him, they accused Jesus of sinning by violating their Sabbath regulations. And Jesus says this in Luke 13, 15, and 16. Jesus answered him, you hypocrites. This is the ruler of the synagogue, actually, that Jesus is answering. You hypocrites. Does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it away to water it? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, who Satan bound for 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath day? Jesus is saying, you take better care of your animals than you're wanting to take care of this lady. You're more concerned about the welfare of an ox that you might have tied up somewhere, even on the Sabbath day. You take care of your ox on the Sabbath day, but you don't want me to cast out a demon out of this woman who is a human being made in the image of God and who's been afflicted by the devil for 18 years. You don't want me to take care of her? When you're taking care of your monetary possessions, your physical possessions, like an ox, so is the ox more important than the human being? You see, you're making friends of unrighteous mammon over here. You're focused on the things of this world. Okay, now in the next chapter, a very similar thing happens in Luke chapter 14. There's a man who has the dropsy. You know what the dropsy is? That was this having all kinds of fluid under your skin so that you would become very puffy. Jesus heals him on that day, and he gets the same kind of accusation. And we won't take the time to look at that. But then, go to chapter 15. What happens in chapter 15? Luke 15 is a very important chapter because it contains three stories about things that were lost. And you remember, it starts off with the lost sheep. A man had 100 sheep, he lost one, and he was willing to go to great lengths to save that sheep. Then you come to the story of the lost coin. A woman had 10 pieces of silver, and she lost one. And what did she do? She swept her house to try to find that one coin. And then when she found it, she called her friends together and said, "Rejoice with me because I found this one coin." And then you get to the story of the lost boy, or what we call the prodigal son. And he had wandered away from home. You know the story. He came back. And that story is really about the elder brother, because the elder brother was in the position of those Pharisees to whom Jesus was speaking. And why did he tell them those three stories about lost things? He told them those stories because Jesus was trying to save sinners. And in the very first verse of Luke chapter 15, we read that he was eating with the publicans and with the sinners, and he was eating with them as an evangelistic effort. He was reaching out to the lost, trying to save them, and the Jews didn't like that. The Jewish leadership said, "Here's this guy who's eating with sinners. Can you believe that?" And of course, it was an evangelistic outreach. Jesus was trying to save them. And Jesus says, "Can you understand a man who loses a sheep? Can you understand how that he would go to great lengths to try to save a sheep?" And they would all be saying, "Of course, that makes perfect sense. Every shepherd loses a sheep, he's going to go try to save the one." Can you understand a woman who loses a coin, and the coin is just nowhere to be found, and she's got 10, but she's lost one, so she sweeps her house? Oh, they could understand that. Everybody who loses money, if you've misplaced some money of any value, you're going to go try to search your house and find it. That's happened to me not too long ago. You just misplaced it. Don't know where it is. I'll look for that. What about a son? Let's raise the stakes a little bit. What about a son? And those Pharisees were in the position of the elder brother, who, when the son came home, were angry about it and didn't think the father should be paying attention to the lost boy. Why? Because they had made friends with unrighteous mammon. They were so concerned about worldly things. They were concerned with coins that had the image of Caesar, but they weren't concerned about human beings that bear the very image of God. You see, they had their priorities all mixed up. And then turn the page, and we're to Luke 16. We're to our story about the parable of the unjust steward, the conclusion of which is, you cannot be friends with God and money. And Jesus tells an ironic tale about somebody who lies and cheats in order to get more money. And at the end, he says, make friends of unrighteous mammon, and then you can go to heaven. And everybody there got the point. Everybody understood that Jesus was using some kind of irony or sarcasm. Then, at the end of Luke 16, you've got another story. But it's a historical account about a rich man and Lazarus. And one of the reasons you know it's a true story is that Jesus names the man. Jesus doesn't give the names of men in parables, but he gives the name of Lazarus because Lazarus was a real man. And there was a rich man and Lazarus, and you know the rich man is the one who was lost. Because in his life, as Abraham says to him from the other side, this is a rare glimpse into the afterlife. Abraham speaks to him and says, "Son, in your life you enjoyed what? You enjoyed your good things. That is, you're rich in your life. And this Lazarus was poor, but now he's in glory and you're in torment. Which one will lead you to eternal habitations? Money or the grace of God? Unrighteous mammon or a relationship with your heavenly Father? Which?" And I submit to you the parable of the unjust steward is a very valuable lesson to remind us to watch our relationship with money very carefully. Watch our contribution to the Lord's work very carefully and make sure that we are giving like we ought to. Watch our attitude toward our income. And make sure that we are not focusing our whole lives around how to increase my income a little bit. Watch our miserliness so that we are hesitant to give. We should not be hesitant to give. Help us. We should pray to God. Help us to have the right relationship to our money. And that's the point of this parable of the unjust steward. We can't love the world. 1 John 2 and verse 15 says, don't love the world or the things that are in the world. Maybe in your life, you've been in the position of loving the world, and you have fallen in love with the wrong things, and you want to fall back in love with God. As Revelation chapter 2 and verse 4 says, you want to rekindle that first love. You used to love God first, but now you've started to love money, or maybe your career, or maybe some other thing that might be okay in and of itself, but you've let that take a priority in your life over your service to God, and you know what that is. Covetousness, the Bible says, is idolatry. Have you put up an idol over God, something you pursue more than you pursue your relationship with God, take it down today. Be restored to faithfulness today. We'll pray with you and for you. Maybe you've never obeyed the gospel. You've never named the name of Jesus as your Savior, and you want to be baptized into water just as Kim was this morning. Before I offer the invitation, I want to say this. It reminds me that Kim's last name is Weir. I was told that. It's her last name is not Hybe. And so we need to bear that in mind. She has the same name that Miss Rachel Hybe has as her maiden name. And so I announced that wrongly this morning, and I'm sorry about that. So Kim's name is Weir. And they're going to be they're not here right now because they're going to the thing at Piedmont Road this evening where many of our young people will be going too. So we'll try to make sure that that's clarified in the bulletin, and you will probably see the address for her, and so you can send her a card and encourage her as she's obeyed the gospel today. She had her sins washed away this morning. What we did this morning was not just something that we do because we like to see a show like that. There wasn't anything about that. It was about contacting the blood of Jesus in the watery grave of baptism. Kim this morning was buried with Christ into baptism, into water, so that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, so she too could rise to walk in newness of life. That's Romans chapter 6, verses 4 and following. Do you want to do the same thing now? If so, then come right now as together we stand and sing.